Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe des Pirate Gaming Podcast. Dieses Jahr feierte die GDC Europe und die Gamescom ihr zweites Jubiläum, wobei es natürlich einige interessante Neuerungen im Messekonzept gab. Am Organisationschaos hat sich leider noch nicht wirklich etwas verändert, aber zu dem Hin und Her konntet ihr ja bereits auf unserer Website lesen. Immerhin, trotz diverser organisatorischer Pannen waren beide Veranstaltungen gut besucht. Die GDC Europe legte sogar einen Besucherrekord hin, der beim Check-in am Montag dann aber doch für einige Verzögerungen gesorgt hat. Auf beiden Veranstaltungen gab es dieses Jahr jedenfalls wieder einige sehr spannende Spieleprojekte, von denen wir euch in unserer heutigen Ausgabe mehr erzählen möchten. Wir waren dazu auf der GDC und auf der Gamescom unterwegs und haben mit einigen Entwicklerstudios gesprochen. Unser heutiger Podcast wird daher auch komplett auf Englisch sein. Da wir aber wissen, dass die meisten von euch synchronisierte Fassungen von Spielen ohnehin nicht so gerne mögen wie das Original, dürft ihr euch damit auch auf die Originalstimmen der Entwickler freuen. Und das erwartet euch in unserem heutigen Podcast. Guild Wars 2. Im Nachfolger des populären MMO-Titels will der Hersteller ArenaNet ganz neue Wege gehen. Mit einem neuen Eventsystem soll das althergebrachte Questen gleich ganz abgeschafft werden. Wie genau das funktioniert und welche Innovationen noch im Titel stecken, erklärt uns Eric Flannum, Lead Game Designer von Guild Wars 2. Technisch wird es danach in unserem Interview mit Sean Tracy von Crytek. Mit der CryEngine 3 will das Frankfurter Studio den Konsolenmarkt erobern und trotzdem ganz vorne in der Grafik bleiben. Sean verrät uns, wie Crytek dies möglich gemacht hat und plaudert über die Bedeutung von lizenzierten Engines für den Markt. Neben Technik ist auch das Thema Community für Entwicklerstudios wichtig. Gerade Online-Titel können ohne eine lebendige und zufriedene Community nicht lange existieren. Megan Rodberg, Senior Community Manager bei Turbine, erklärt uns, warum Herr der Ringe Online nach 3 Jahren zum Free-to-Play-Titel wird. Und zu guter Letzt haben wir das Entwicklerteam von The Witcher 2 vor das Mikro geholt. Bereits bei der Pressevorführung hatte das polnische Team uns mit seinem schrägen Humor überzeugt. Zunächst wies man uns auf Notizblöcke in der Pressemappe hin, die dann aber bereits alle wichtigen Notizen und einige ziemlich verrückte Skizzen enthielten. Denn man wisse ja, wie beschäftigt wir Journalisten seien. Der Pressemappe hatten die Entwickler außerdem Bastelbögen beigelegt, mit denen man aus Pappmaché die Spielfigur Geralt und einige Wachen nachbauen konnte. Das Papercraft of Kings getaufte Pseudospiel hat inzwischen regelrechten Kultstatus erlangt, sodass es die Bastelbögen sogar zum Download gibt. Aber auch das Spiel überzeugt mit einigen interessanten Neuerungen im Storytelling und der Technologie. Was genau, erzählen euch die Entwickler selbst. Los geht's aber nun mit Eric Flannum zu Guild Wars 2. All right, right now we're taking a look at Guild Wars 2. We already had a rather interesting panel at GDC, which showed that the game has some really, really innovative aspects. And, well, we're sitting down with one of the people from NCSoft. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Eric Flannum, and I'm the lead game designer of Guild Wars 2.
So what in particular have you been working on? What was your focus on the game production?
In particular, I lead the design team, so that means I'm responsible for kind of maintaining the overall vision of the game and making sure that everything that goes into the game is kind of going into that that same vision, that we're all working towards the same goals. At the same time, you know, managing an entire team of designers, I think we have somewhere in the lines of 30 designers working on the game, so quite a few people, yeah.
When you do sequels for games, you always have the choice to stay a little bit with the original one to please the community who like the game, or to innovate. And at GDC, we learned that you innovated quite a lot. You abandoned the classic quest system and basically focused on a new system which you called dynamic events. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so the dynamic event system actually came about from our desire to provide a more cooperative multiplayer experience in an MMO and to allow players to feel that they are affecting their environment. And so what we did was we looked at events, looked at quests, and noticed some of the things that quests did that were sort of not good for multiplayer play. you know, quests required players to always be on the same quest step. They threw up these kind of walls of text at you. You had a lot of quests, and so it kind of started devaluing themselves. So, you know, anytime you have 30 of something in a game, the game is telling you that those things are not important individually, but they are important kind of in a big group. And so we looked at all those things, and we thought, well, we could make a system that did away with all those problems, but still provided players with a bit of direction and excitement and rewarded them for kind of being heroic. So that's where our dynamic event system came from. So the way it works is basically a player will go into an area where an event is occurring, and regardless of when they enter that area, they might enter it right at the beginning or they might enter it towards the end, they will be informed that the event is happening and they'll be able to partake in it without sort of accepting it. If they participate in the event, and every event has sort of a participation criteria that it looks for, which is very mild. So if you participate in it, then you get rewarded for participating in it. And that's pretty much it. And so what that does is it ensures that everyone in the area has a shared goal. So you can be sure that all other players want to kill centaurs if centaurs are attacking. It makes it so that players don't have sort of their own personal goals. Every player is not attempting to kill 10 centaurs by themselves, which means that other players in the area are only helping you complete the event more quickly. They're not getting in your way. They're not eating up resources that you feel you're entitled to. And so it prevents a lot of the player conflict that you see that quest systems kind of encourage. And it encourages players to have a really cooperative experience.
So in addition to the cooperative experience, you always have storytelling in MMOs as well. What impact does the event system have on storytelling? I would imagine that it's a little bit difficult because every player experiences something different depending on when he enters which realm.
Yeah. So the idea behind sort of the storytelling aspect of events is that events are not kind of a personal story for your character, but instead they're the story in the backdrop of the world upon which your personal story takes place. And so what I mean by that is you might learn that a particular character is responsible in your personal story for these bandits, or you might suspect that some noble's betraying the city, that sort of thing. And then when you go out into the world, you see the bandits out attacking fields and poisoning wells and doing all that sort of thing. And so those events kind of reinforce everything that you've seen in your personal story, and they work together in a very, very cool way. And they sort of provide a backdrop for the world. And when we decided to make our events, whenever we make a single event, we look at, is that event really immediate? We don't want events that require a lot of narrative and require a lot of pre-knowledge in order to know what's going on. We chose to make our events things that are very visual. So if I see a water reservoir and I see a bandit with a bucket and they're called a bandit poisoner and they're pouring green liquid into the reservoir, I can be pretty sure I know what's going on there. If I see a bandit running through a field with a torch and I see him setting fire to bales of hay, I know there's something bad going on there. I don't need to have read you know, anything about bandits or anything like that to know that that's a bad thing and I need to stop it, and that I'm a hero, I should stop that sort of thing. And so that's the way narrative kind of works. It's kind of an overall context for the world. And then for the personal story, that's where we do really serious kind of narratives, where you get you know, kind of characters betraying other characters and conflict between particular individuals and that sort of thing.
So when you trigger some of these dynamic events, you can be sure that there are different players with different progression levels in the respective area. How do you ensure they can play together?
So we do that in a couple of ways. So first off, we look at the number of players in an area, and we scale the event based on who's trying to participate in the area. We don't want it to be griefable, so we look at actual participation instead of just relying on who's in the area. So as soon as players start trying to participate in an event, they'll cause that event to scale up. Now, for some events, it's very, very easy to do this. So an event that is, say, waves of bandits attacking an area. You can make the success of waves bigger or smaller based on how many players you have. For things like boss encounters, it gets a little tougher. So for boss encounters, we do things like give our bosses new abilities so that they can deal with the larger number of players that are in there. And again, we're not doing our scaling to try to make the event more difficult. If we made the event actually more difficult, then what would happen is you'd kind of want other players to stay away, because if other players come in and make the event more difficult, you're going to want them to go away. Instead, what we're trying to do is avoid the problem where you have five players and the boss is kind of a cool encounter that takes 10 minutes, and you get 20 players in and you annihilate the boss in 30 seconds, and it's not actually very fun for anybody. So what our boss scaling does is it doesn't make the boss harder, it just makes the boss a little bit more reasonable for a lot of players to fight. And so we'll do things. For example, we have a boss called the Drake Broodmother, which is this giant drake, and she needs a way to deal with more players attacking her. And so if more players show up, she'll unlock an ability where she can spin around and hit everybody with her tail, knock players away. It's a great tool for her to be able to kind of counteract multiple players. More players will still probably defeat her sooner than, say, one player would. But it's not to the point where it ruins the fun for everybody. So,
talking about the fun, many MMOs have the problem that the combat systems somehow get repetitive after a while. What are the innovations in Guild Wars 2's combat system?
That's a good question. So we wanted to make our combat system more visually interesting. We wanted to do away, in Guild Wars 1, we had a lot of skills that had an awful lot of complexity on them. And it was complexity of the sort that you had to read the skill in order to really understand it. We wanted skills that were visually explain themselves. And so I think we have sort of an unprecedented, for an MMO, a number of different skill effects and animations going on. So we wanted things like, we've got a skill called Phoenix in the game, where you send out this fiery bird and it hits everything on a line and then explodes at its target and comes back to you, and then it heals you when it comes back to you. So that's a lot of things in a skill. And we wanted to make that all very visually apparent. And so we actually released a video of that without any explanation, and our players were able to go, oh, well, this is what it's obviously doing. And so that was actually really cool for us, because that let us know that we had kind of succeeded with what we set out to do. And that was something that we wanted. We also wanted our combat to be a little bit more active, and so we did away with auto attack, because auto attack, not only did it encourage players to kind of shut their brains off during combat, which is fine for some games, but we just didn't want that for ours. You could sit there and, just let your character auto-attack and not really have to worry about tactics or positioning or anything like that. But it also had the effect of when you actually did use skills, it kind of interrupted the flow of those skills. You never quite knew when your character was animating, whether he was animating because he was auto-attacking or whether he was animating because you had just used a skill. And so in order to get that feeling that was very important to us, which was a direct correlation to, I pressed a button, I immediately used a skill, and it feels very good to do that. The basic act of using a skill should feel very good. That's one of the things that we wanted to get out of our combat. And so it was very important to us, and that's why we don't have auto attack. We also wanted a game that encouraged a lot of positioning, and so we have a lot of skills that do things like hit everything out from a straight line, or hit in a cone, or do more damage when you're behind or to the side of a target, things like that, or have an additional effect when you're behind the target. And so we wanted to encourage players to move around during combat. And so another thing that we do that's a little bit different, we don't have a lot of skills that kind of keep you stationary. Most of the skills in the game can be used while you're moving and can be used when you're out of range of a target. So if I swing a sword, I'm able to just swing that sword. I don't get that you're out of range message that you get in a lot of other games. And so we wanted that way we make our combat feel like it's got a very immediate kind of impact to it. At the same time, we recognize that we are making an RPG, even if it is more of an action RPG, and we didn't want to make our combat go to the point where it was like FPS combat, where you had to really, really aim and things like that, because we know a lot of our players just kind of can't do that. And so our combat system is kind of a system where it has the kind of ease of aiming and things like that that other MMOs have, but at the same time, it is also very active. And so we kind of live somewhere in between your average MMO and, a completely skill-based game like an FPS.
So, So one very important aspect is the social aspect as well. Some players drop out after a while from MMOs because they can no longer play with their friends since they have more time, thus level faster. The event system could change a little bit of that. But what about the high-level contents of the game?
So this is actually a good question. So we have a lot of one of our core tenets of the game is that it should always be easy to play with your friends. And so we actually have a sidekick system, which some players might recognize from a game like City of Heroes, where if you group with a friend, you can either put yourself up to their level or come down to their level. And so players are always able to play with players of differing levels because they can always group together and then dictate what level kind of they play at. In addition to that, one of the things that's really exciting for us is so if a player who's very high level goes to an area of the game that's very low level, they will automatically be sidekicked downward to that level. And what that does for us, the player is still pretty strong for that level. He can still kind of annihilate things. But what he can't do is sort of annihilate things in a way that's not fun. He's not going to one-hit everything. He's not going to do one AoE and kill everything in sight. So he can't ruin the experience for other players. But more importantly, what that means is for a level 80 character, which is our max level, the entire game opens up to you. You can, if you were a Char player who never got to see the Silvari area, you can go back to the Silvari area and you can experience the low-level Silvari content. If you're nostalgic for an area of the game that you remember, wow, I used to play with my friends back then, it was really fun, I can go back to that area and experience those events over again. And so the game is very replayable. Our personal storyline also makes it very replayable in that you can make a brand new character and experience a very different sort of story than you had before. You can, you know, play a different race and have a completely different experience. Or if you like to play your one character, you can go find a friend who maybe is playing through a different storyline, and you can go sidekick down, and you can play with that friend through their story and experience what their story is like in addition to what you had. And so replayability and kind of opening the entire game up is very important for us. You know, our leveling system is designed to be kind of a good achievement progress sort of marker. It's not designed to simply fill in time. And so our level system actually flattens out in the around the level 30 area to where it doesn't take longer time to level when you're 30 to 31 versus 70 to 71. It takes, you know, I think we've pegged it at roughly an hour and a half, which means, you know, you can play through our game and get to max level in a very reasonable amount of time. The idea is that we have both a lot of things for you to do when you get to higher level, and then we also have a lot of things that encourage you to make more characters and to play through the game again. And so, you know, we try to provide a lot of different experiences for different types of players.
Sounds very promising. When does the game hit the shelves?
So that's a good question. The answer that, you know, I think everybody doesn't want to hear, but I think is the right answer for most game developers is, you know, when it's ready. And the reason for that, let me explain that. A lot of people say that and they don't really explain why that is. So let me explain why that is. So it's not like we actually know when the game is going to come out and we just won't tell you. We really don't know. So what we could tell you is if the game that we have on paper, and we do have the game planned out on paper, if we were to make that and everything were to go perfectly well, when we implemented everything, it was like, okay, that worked out exactly the way we thought it would work out. If that happened, we could tell you when the game would ship. We would know. But what actually happens is you put something in and you find out that it just wasn't a great idea. You know, it seemed like it was going to be a really good idea. It seemed like it was going to be a really fun encounter, but it turned out to not be a fun encounter. And then what we need to do, if we're going to make a great game, is we need to not accept the fact that we put this thing in and it didn't work the way that we dreamed it would work. We have to respond to, you know, what we're seeing and what our players are seeing and what, you know, our testers are seeing, and we have to fix that thing. And so in game development, it's very hard to say how many of those things that you plan for will turn out like that, where you maybe have to replace it with something different or you have to alter it significantly. And so the real answer is it's just hard to estimate those things. And since we want the game to be a great game, you know, we had a really ambitious goal set for ourselves. When we started making the game, we said, you know what we should do? This is the goal we should make. This is what we should settle for. We want to make the greatest MMO ever created, and we're not going to settle for anything less than that. And, you know, it's maybe a little bit arrogant to say that, but at the same time, It's a high-level goal. It's a goal that's going to keep us pushing ourselves. It's a goal that's going to keep us making the game better and better and better. And it's the sort of goal that will result in a better game overall for our fans. And so when we feel like we've accomplished that goal is when we'll release the game. And hopefully, you know, we will never release a game that is the sort of thing where fans are like, well, if they'd only taken 6 more months, they could have tuned this thing to make it better. We want to take that additional time and make sure the game is all it can be.
So to wrap things up, I guess once the game gets released, we get a really innovative Guild Wars 2 and a very polished one. And I thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much.
So right now we're at Crytek. Sean P. Tracy right in front of me. Please introduce yourself. What's your profession here at Crytek? What are you doing?
Sure. So my name is Sean Tracy. I'm a senior field applications engineer for Crytek. Basically what that means is I work within licensing. So I work with the licensees. I teach them how to use the engine. I also showcase the engine to licensees that are saying making a racing game or making a third-person adventure game. And I prove that the engine can indeed do pretty much any platform and any title. So,
straight from the start of the company Crytek, the company has already proven that it's always at the bleeding edge of everything that's possible in gaming technology. Often not so playable for the average computer, but always bleeding edge and always very impressive. So, your engine has become a great licensing title. Right now, if you look back at the past years, how has the company evolved? How important has the engine licensing become for you?
Actually, it's changed a lot over the last few years here. We've become a very high-profile engine. A lot of really AAA developers have started looking at us, and I mean the really big developers. I can't name them by name, unfortunately, because we announce them through press conferences or whatnot. But I mean, we've been having meetings with some of the largest game developers in the world. We've become a very high-profile engine because of the fact that we're now going out onto consoles, because a lot of people were just waiting for Crytek to go to consoles, and then as soon as that engine was on consoles, CryEngine, they were ready to develop with it. So
consoles are an interesting topic, especially concerning CryEngine. People always said, how do you stuff such an amazing engine onto the rather limited platform of different consoles?
So what we have a 60-man R&D team that is full of very, very intelligent people. I mean, their math skills, their programming skills are above and beyond. So basically, it's those people that are doing the magic, and they're the magic behind the entire engine. And I mean, what we do, we have a very visionary and perfectionist president, Mr. Pat Yearley, as you know. And basically, he sets the quality bar for us. He says, this is the quality that we have to achieve. And a really good line that he says a lot of the times is that we can't let us beat us. So we need to be able to beat Crysis 1 in graphical fidelity and performance, really, in the end. So that's what's really driving us to do some of the things that we're doing on consoles. But it actually spurs the development of certain things. So things like deferred lighting, things like stereoscopic on consoles. These are really interesting things that are coming out of the R&D team. And basically, any of the really big sort of technical improvements that we're making, we're just really obsessed with having those work on console. So we have this thing, you know, it's a nice line I like. It's called disrespect the impossible. So we have a lot of people telling us, no, you know, you can never have Crysis 1 run on console. You can never have CryEngine running on console. You can't have, you know, 1,500 lights in the scene. You can't do stereoscopic on PS3. We love it when people say that because it's just a motivation for us to actually prove them wrong.
So you've progressed a lot with the engine, and right now here at GDC, you've shown some of the new features of CryEngine 3, one of which we could see at the presentation was stereoscopic 3D. I have to say, there's been quite a little bit of buzz about 3D, especially in cinema. Avatar triggered a lot last year. Was that also an inspiration, or was that an idea that you came up first off when concepting CryEngine 3?
That's actually a really good question. I'm not sure whereabouts the stereoscopic drive came from within Crytek. All I know is that there was some particular R&D people that were working on the stereoscopic rendering, and there was a huge breakthrough made. And when they demonstrated this breakthrough to Chafet, he knew immediately that this needed to go on to consoles, and it needed to ship with Crysis 2. So once that was done, we ported that off to consoles, we tested it, made sure we weren't losing any performance for not only our licensees, but for our players as well. Because when we're licensing the engine, a lot of licensees do want to have this stereoscopic rendering, but they don't want to do too much work to actually have it implemented. So they don't really have to do any work, and that's what I was really showing in the presentation. But yeah, I'm not really exactly sure where the drive for the 3D came from, but I mean, absolutely, it's the perfect time for it because there's so much content coming out within the next 6 months, really, in 3D. And now you're seeing 3D TVs and all the hardware that you need to run 3D dropping in price exponentially. Like, I mean, we just, our first 3D TV, we purchased for about 6,000, 7,000 euros. It was very, very expensive about 6 to 8 months ago. But now at this point, we just bought a TV just before GDC here, and it was about 1,600 euros. So, I mean, it's dropped exponentially in price. So I really hope that that actually allows the consumer to really experience all this 3D content that's going to be coming out.
Last year at Gamescom, there was a first presentation about stereoscopic 3D. Yep. Again, Avatar was the driving force there. But it wasn't really convincing. There was a lot of ghosting, a lot of flickering. It hurt the eyes after quite a while. So was there also a motivation to do better and to be basically bleeding edge again?
Yes, absolutely. So what we had done initially at that first GDC, I think it was a totally different implementation of the stereo than what you're seeing now. So this was before we made this major breakthrough called the Screen Space Reprojection Stereo System. So we were actually doing, at that time, generic dual head rendering, which is actually just a double render. Now, the only problem with that is there's no way to do that on console. The problem is that your performance would be exactly half of what you normally would because you actually have to render two cameras. In this case now, because we're doing this in a way that we actually synthesize the second image, it's much, much faster. And in the end, Chavat was not happy with the way the 3D was looking on a generic dual head. Do we still do that that way? Sure, we do. Does it look better? Absolutely. It looks much better.
So if we come back to the multi-platform question, there's been a lot of movement in the industry in the past months. Microsoft has been working to tie Xbox and PC platform together. Steam has expanding to Mac platform. And a lot of games are released now. You buy one license and you can play it on any platform you have at home. And now the technological difficulties there are obvious. You have to adapt to the respective platform, to the respective controllers. Do you think Crytek can really push the industry forward by creating a product that others can easily use to build their game on various platforms?
Mm-hmm. Without a doubt. I think we can bring the quality bar up immensely across all games. Anybody that wants to take their genre onto CryEngine will notice a vast improvement, not only on their development time because they can iterate so much faster, but on their quality bar because, I mean, we've worked with these 60 R&D personnel. We've got, I mean, immense amount of man hours within the engine. And, I mean, this is a lot of the times the companies just can't spend that kind of money or that kind of time to catch up to everybody else. Now, we're definitely the most powerful engine within the world right now. It's us versus Epic at all times. Now, for the developers, this is just a good thing that's happening because we're trying to push that quality bar higher and higher and higher. When we do things like DirectX 11, when we come things like tessellation, all these new things that may be coming within the engine, we're just going to set the bar even higher. So, I mean, once people license the CryEngine, they know that they're going to get the top-notch engine and they know they're going to get the newest features the fastest. So, yes.
So to wrap things up, what would you say would be the feature that's most exciting to you right now?
The feature that's most exciting to me right now is deferred lighting, to be honest, and that's been most exciting to me in the last year. I really like stereoscopic rendering as well, but I don't have a 3D TV at home. Now, I'm waiting for them to drop down a little bit in price. Stereoscopic is the big push for this particular show, but I'm still really big into the deferred lighting. The fact that I can, as a designer, because this is really what my job is designing levels and designing games, for me to be able to put 2,500 lights within a scene, that's pretty awesome. That's a pretty awesome power. And, I mean, it can bring such life to your game that I think it's the best thing. I guess it's because I worked a lot within CryEngine 2. And, I mean, we were really limited to, you know, 4 to 6 lights or so within a scene. So now that I can just have these unlimited lights, I mean, I can make my scenes look so nice. The other thing that's also really exciting is global illumination or our screen space global illumination. It's really exciting. Basically, what that does is if you have two different colored objects sort of right next to each other, you'll get this light reflection or refraction, I should call it. And it will actually color certain objects around it depending depending on how the light bounce is happening. And I think that's really cool too, because it's kind of a it's not a super noticeable effect right away, but it's something that you actually really makes it feel more real, because that's how light works in real life, rather than just being, you know, light or dark. And that's how kind of older games were. If you remember something like Doom, it's either light or it's really dark, or it's really light or it's really dark. But this gives you all those steps in between. So pretty much those two features are my most exciting ones, I think.
So there was a rather interesting panel today about art direction in Crysis 2, and you could really take a look at how technology, for once, pushes the bar and how creatives can really use it to create an amazing scenario. New York, for instance. But how much power would the PC gamer probably need to get the whole experience of Crysis 2?
This is one of the coolest things, and probably why I like Deferred Lights and GI and everything over it, is because these are things that are bringing the PC performance so much faster. If you loaded a CryEngine 2, a Crysis 1 level on CryEngine 3, the performance is going to be exponentially faster. The amount of stuff that we're doing to optimize the engine for consoles is really benefiting the PC. The frame rates, all the draw calls have been reduced quite a bit, and we're also a lot more strict on the way we use our code, the way we refactor our systems. So, I mean, the performance is actually significantly better. All the demonstrations that I've been doing here at GDC, I've been just doing on a GTX 260 card. So, I mean, that's not even a really high-end card. That's a really mid-level card right now. So when Crysis launches in a few months, that's going to be, I mean, at the low end, really. And, I mean, you're going to be able to run these things very, very fast, and I really think it's the fact that we're optimizing for consoles, but we're able to bring these optimizations over to PC without sacrificing the quality.
Okay, I'm sitting here with a new guest, Megan Rodberg from Turbine. You've been busy on Lord of the Rings Online for quite a while now. Please introduce yourself to your listeners.
Sure, I'm Megan Rodberg. I'm the Senior Community Manager for Turbine. We're the developer for the Lord of the Rings Online, Dungeons & Dragons Online, and Asheron's Call.
So back in the days when you started developing Lord of the Rings Online, there was a little bit of a split fan base. Some said, hey, I would love to see the movie as a game. Others said, the book is so much richer. Which was your approach when you got the idea to do Lord of the Rings as a game?
Well, we had the literary license for the Lord of the Rings Online, so in some ways we actually had to be careful not to make the game look too much like the movies. I think, though, that we found having the literary license gave us a lot more material to work with than the movies. We weren't limited to what was in the movies. We could actually expand on what was pretty much anything that was mentioned in the books. So we have entire regions that are based on just small mentions in the works.
Did this also leave you more creative freedom in the entire production?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, again, we weren't limited in how things looked or how things were created or how they sounded. We were able to use the books to base all of this off of.
So you're always basically the interface to the community, the link to the community. When the game was released, or even earlier when the announcements were made, the beta started, how did players, or basically fans of Lord of the Rings, respond to the way that you've been recreating the world of Tolkien?
They're very positive. When we first announced, originally the game was Middle Earth Online, which was more of a sandbox MMO. When we acquired the license from our original publisher, we changed the name to the Lord of the Rings Online, and in some ways we changed the direction of the game. We made it more of a game with more direction within it. You were playing a game rather than just being in the world. So that, I think, frightened some of our existing community members. They were afraid that we were going to take the game in the wrong direction. Some of them actually were concerned that we would be like the movies. But overall, I think that we've redeemed ourselves. I think we do have a world that is very true to Middle-earth, very true to the feel of the works. And overall, our Tolkien fans have been very pleased.
So the game has been out for a while. You had several expansions, adding new regions of Middle-earth. And of course, Tolkien's world delivers so much material. I mean, you could build a whole continent, and the storytelling possibilities are probably endless. So where are you now with Lord of the Rings Online? How has the game evolved until now?
So we started out, the game originally starts right as Frodo leaves the Shire. So right, just when he leaves Crick Hollow, which again is the difference between the movies and the game, he leaves directly in the movies. He leaves directly for leaves the Shire directly after receiving the ring. In the books, he actually doesn't leave until for several months. So that's where the game begins. Since then, we have followed the path of the Fellowship all the way down through Moria and have now emerged from Moria into Lothlorien and into the Forest of Mirkwood. And now with the new book that's coming out, we're expanding into the region of Anadwaith. So we have a long way to go until Mordor, a very long way to go to Mordor. Our fans are really looking forward to. We hear Rohan a lot. So we will get to Rohan, we will get to Isengard, and we will eventually get to Mordor, but it is a big world. So.
So you definitely have material for several years left.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
So, but still at the moment, there's something pretty interesting going on. We had a lot of talks at GDC about free-to-play business models or simply going into another direction in the monetization of games. And right now, you're doing something very special. You're creating a hybrid of free-to-play and subscription base as before. What was the intention behind going this down this new road?
Well, I think the subscription model, it works for some games, and some games will retain it, but I think that free-to-play and microtransactions are becoming a much more... it's a business model that's really starting to work more and more, and more companies are moving toward it. Our first game to make this switch was Dungeons & Dragons Online. It was originally a subscription game, but we moved it to the free-to-play hybrid model last year, and it was very successful. You can still subscribe if you want. If you subscribe, you get 500 turbine points every month to spend in the store to buy, you know, content or potions or anything. Although you get all of the content already, but if you want to buy more character slots or anything like that. Or you can come in as a free player, and you can actually earn turbine points in the game through the favor system and use those points to buy the content. Or if you just want to skip ahead, you can spend money to buy turbine points to purchase the things in the game. So this worked out really well for Dungeons & Dragons Online. If you look, actually, most of the stories in the media that cover the free-to-play and hybrid business models, they mention Dungeons & Dragons Online as having sort of pioneered this. So that success led us, we looked at the Lord of the Rings Online, and, I mean, it's been doing very well. It's been out for 3.5 years, more. But it could do better with this model. I think a lot of games could, and so we're making the switch.
When concepting games, many game designers already have the business model in mind to really apply the game mechanics to something that will appeal to players and also will make them curious and make them want to spend money on items or upgrades or whatever is applied to the respective game. Now, you've done the other approach. You had your finished game, or basically an MMO is really never finished, but you had the ship game, and you went on and added the separate model. How difficult was it to balance both of these systems in accordance with game mechanics?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of work, and it took... It took quite a while for DDO and again for Lotro to make the change. We have to be very careful of balance. One of the things we do is we don't sell... The stores are more about convenience than anything else. They're for purchasing fast travel or accelerating your deed progression, things like that. We don't sell high-level gear. We don't sell high-level items or anything like that that could potentially upset the balance of the game. It does help with Lotro and with DDO. Both of them are PvE games. They're not PvP-focused games. So we don't have to worry about as much about unbalancing the PvP in the game, because PvE is really the focus. So we do have to be very careful. We try not to. We try to make sure that if there's something in the store, there is a comparable way to get it in the game. And if not that item, it'll be something very similar.
At your booth, you had a chart showcasing the three different models you can use within the free-to-play version. Could you please explain those in detail? What can the player buy, and what can he actually do with these three versions?
Sure. So if you're a subscriber, you still have access to absolutely everything that you had before, your character slots, all of the content. If you purchased the Mines of Moria or the Siege of Mirkwood, you have access to that content. And as long as you're subscribed, you get the 500 points every month to spend in the store. We also, if you're a free player, it means essentially that you have never spent any money at all. You've never purchased any of the games in the store. You've never entered any like retail code. You've never purchased any turbine points. If that's the case, you're limited in the number of character slots that you have. You are limited in the amount of storage that you have. You don't have access. You have access to all of the regions, but not necessarily all of the quests within those regions. One thing that I'm not sure if I've mentioned before is that while you're playing the game, if you're doing deeds in the game, you can actually you earn turbine points by completing those deeds. So as a player, as a free player, you can earn enough free turbine points to purchase content and character slots and unlock all of those things in the store. We have a middle tier that is basically anyone who has ever entered a retail key for the client or any of the expansions or has ever bought turbine points. They don't have the same limits on, I believe they get, I can't remember if it's one or two more character slots. They don't have the same limitations on mail and chat and things like that. And again, they'll have all of the content that they've purchased in the store. It's almost like I don't know if in Europe you have this term, but rent to own. Yeah, so you know, for the free and the premium players, it's very much like a rent to own rather than a subscription. So
for the players who may have liked the World of Tolkien, but were hesitant to play on a subscription model, they can probably look forward. When's the launch date of this new model?
September 10th.
Okay. Then all I have left to say is good luck with the relaunch, if I might say. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
So we're sitting down with the developers of The Witcher 2. Hi, folks. Could you please introduce yourselves?
Hello. My name is Marek Ziemak, and I'm a level designer in The Witcher 2 project.
Hi, guys. My name is Konrad Tomaszkiewicz. I am lead quest implementation in the project Red.
Hi, I'm Jan Bartkowicz, and I'm a story writer for The Witcher 2.
So we saw a pretty impressive presentation just about 5 minutes ago. You spend a lot of time working on very much new content for The Witcher 2, so you really expanded the scope of the game. We heard that there were 16 different storyline endings. What does the player have to do to go to one of these endings?
Okay, so basically it's like 16 world states you can leave the world at. I mean, some of them are different, differ more than the others, like from each other. So basically you'll get like really two big paths you can end the game at. And within each of those paths, there's like eight variables you can really change and, you know, get a feeling that the world looks different when you play the game through. And the decisions that influence the consequences with the game endings are made through the whole game. So it's not only like the last 10% of the game where you know you're making this huge choices just to have like a different cutscene. It's some of them are really determined even in the first chapter of the game. So like really early decisions can narrow the amount of endings you can really see.
That sounds like a lot of effort in story writing. How much time did you spend working on the actual story?
A huge amount of time. Huge, huge amount of time. The story was designed and was rewritten. And then when we finally got this like a coherent storyline to sell, then we've got to making choices, going into details, and it really expanded a lot. So, you know, it's like we have, of course, like a story anchors that will pull you through the story so that you won't get lost in it. But, of course, we'll have like big and small non-linearities. I mean, like the routes you take through a location are like the small non-linearities. The really big story choices, for example, you know, dialogue lines or stuff you save someone or you kill them or stuff like that will affect the storyline, of course. We've got 30% of the game taking place basically in a different location based on what choice you had made. But we're still gonna like give the player some sneak peeks onto what he could have done. For example, because you have run, you had one playthrough, and at the end of the game, you will think, okay, but I could have been with a different alliance. I could have been there. The story could like play through like a little bit different. So why not do that right now? Because we want it to be like a replay value for the game.
We learned that there are not also choices in the story, but also in gameplay. You can be the sneaky guy, you can be the brutal guy. Can you tell us a little bit more about the gameplay style?
Yeah, we have many you know, ways in the gameplay. We can sneak in some quests. We can, for example, we have a new, quite new character development. We have three new branches in this character development. You can specialize in magic, sword, or in alchemy. Of course, in each of these branches, you fight the sword, but you have different moves, you have different abilities, and the gameplay changes in this way. Of course, we have also mini games. We have dice game. We have the arm wrestling game, and a fist fight you saw on the presentation. And in each of the quests, you can, for example, use Axie Signs on someone to get some information, or play with him in dice or arm wrestling and get this information. We have very non-linear quests, and guys from story give us ideas and a storyline of main storyline. And when we work on the quest, we make a new ways, new non-linear solutions, and we write, you know, the placeholders of dialogues, and work after it with the writers to make the big non-linear game.
We also saw really, really large-scale battles. I think that was a really epic battlefield. How does the player actually work within such a large environment with so many NPCs around?
Well, it's that was very hard for us to make this whole battlefield to make it epic, like you saw it. And we have many solutions to give player some gameplay elements in this battlefield, but I don't want to spoil it that, now, because you know it, you will saw it in the game. Yeah.
Okay. Something that also struck me was the amount of detail in the levels and the outdoor areas. So we saw the player was fleeing from a castle and was immediately in a large-scale outdoor environment, and even without a loading screen. So you say you only have four loading screens in the game. Can you tell a little bit about the level design and the technological challenges to create these environments?
Yeah, so basically the game is based on our new engine, the 2D engine, and it allows us to create the game in a way that you won't have to see as many loading screens as you did in Witcher 1. So there are no like loading screens on each door and stuff like that. We're using streaming in the background, so if you have a good enough PC, but it doesn't mean like an extra monster, you know, just like a medium PC, you won't probably see more than four loading screens or so in the game. On those, you know, older PCs, you might see some loading screens during your gameplay while you move from like different big parts of the location to another, but it's still nothing that can be compared to the things we had in Witcher 1. And the locations, of course, are detailed. We put a lot of effort to create them. We got some great artists, we got some great designers, so when it all works together, the locations are really story-driven and beautiful, right? But they're much bigger, and the engine allows us to create that this way.
To wrap things up, what would you say is the feature or the bundle of features that sets The Witcher 2 apart the most from other RPGs?
In my opinion, it's the well-defined character, the well-defined world, and the non-linearity inside of it.
Okay, thanks a lot. We're looking forward to the game, and good luck with the release.
Thank you.
Das war unsere erste Ausgabe zur Gamescom und GDC Europe 2010. In der nächsten Folge nehmen wir das Thema Games-Kompetenz ein wenig näher unter die Lupe. Auf der diesjährigen Gamescom hatte man diesen Bereich massiv ausgebaut, stark vertreten waren dabei die Themen Medienkompetenz und Jugendschutz, aber auch Berufschancen in der deutschen Entwicklerbranche. Wir freuen uns, wenn ihr auch dazu wieder einschaltet.